week of December 18th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 348, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, outside the Dolby Theater, I'm Michael Gills.
Hey, you're in LA. You should have told me. I would have baked you a cake.
Well, you know, I just feel like, hey, we heard that Jimmy Kimmel, he's hosting the Oscars, and he's being paid $15,000, which is kind of insane. I'm like, we'll do it for 10, right? So I'm here to let them know.
Hold on a second. I'm just going to, I'm going to see how much more we make than, actually he makes $15,000 more than us.
At least for hosting the Oscars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Correct. Yes. He makes far more than that for hosting his nightly talk show.
Yeah. $15,000. I mean, why even bother? Why not just say, here's a t-shirt?
Yeah, it's okay.
here's a I hosted the Oscars t-shirt. My God, $15,000. It's almost insulting. Like, not $100,000?
Plus, taxes, he's going to wind up with, you know, nothing, really.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, that was interesting. But he's going to be working in the Oscars. We won't be working next week, will we?
No, we will not. Actually, good point. We will not be working next week because it's the holidays and nothing happens and I'm going to be traveling.
Nothing happens. There's movies every day, but you are too busy.
I'm just too busy. I'm a busy guy. What can I say? In fact, I was so busy this week. Now, in reality, you're in New York and I'm in Los Angeles. And because I'm in New York, you're in New York and I'm in LA. Because I'm in LA, I was given some homework by you, one of which, and this will be the last item that I talk about here, was to see Amelie. Okay, the musical, which is here at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles. But first, you've been talking about this movie all year, it seems like, Hell or High Water. And I finally caught up with it. You liked this movie.
I liked it. I thought you were talking about it more because it was at Cannes and elsewhere.
I didn't catch it in Cannes, but I did finally catch up with it. And I'm actually glad I saw it after the election because, boy, you watch a movie like that and, number one, it's very good. Number two, great acting. And number three, in hindsight, it's a very timely movie.
Well, it's all about inequality and people desperately trying to get by and fight back against the system. It's a B movie about bank robbers, but there's definitely a little bit more on its mind.
That's correct. That's the best. You see, this is why I'm not a critic, because you said in one sentence what I meant to say. The last bookstore, you told me, hey, you know, I read this thing in the New York Times about the last bookstore. It's a bookstore in downtown. Have you ever been there? Well, I kind of had, but I'd only been in the entrance. I didn't really go in, and I'd heard all about the book tunnel that exists there and the maze upstairs.
What's the book tunnel?
Go to my Instagram account. You'll see there's like a tunnel made out of books. It's pretty remarkable. In this bookstore, it's an independent bookstore. It's probably one of the largest bookstores in Los Angeles, if not the largest bookstore, and it sells records too. And it's in downtown Los Angeles, used, new books. It's in an old bank building, so there are bank vaults where you can go inside the vault and inside are books. It's just, it's insane. It's a must visit if you're in Los Angeles, and thank you for prodding me to actually go and kind of walk in beyond the entrance.
Will you go back?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the place was packed and just deservedly so, I might add.
But how was Amelie the musical?
Well, okay. So I loved Amelie the movie. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hate Amelie the musical. I didn't dislike it at all. It was fine. It was kind of uneven. It was whimsical. The staging and the production design was fairly good. You know, it was like kind of interesting. You know, they had puppets at one point. Philippa Sue, who plays Amelie, she of course played Eliza in Hamilton, and she gets like a standing ovation just showing up on stage. And I kind of looked out around me and I thought, how many of you have actually seen Hamilton that you're now giving a 26-year-old who's been in like two Broadway shows, one off Broadway, you know, you're giving her a standing ovation for showing up on stage? You know, I found that kind of fascinating. And she is incredibly talented. So she really does make that show. But that said, the musical numbers are okay. They're not great.
Well, it's a musical. If the musical numbers aren't great, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And it's still, there's no intermission. No intermission at all.
So how long is it?
It's 85 minutes.
Who needs an intermission?
Yeah, it's fine. But it just seems like it's still being worked on before it heads to Broadway in the spring. And it just didn't feel, it felt uneven and not ready.
Yeah, but it's not going to be ready if none of the songs are good.
Well, I agree. Yes. And there's one song that I would just cut entirely. And I just thought, why is this song even in there? There's no reason for it to be in there other than to extend the length of the show.
Well, I will downgrade my expectations for Amelie, but what are our expectations for this week's show?
Okay, well, on this week, we'll break down the numbers on Rogue One. And don't worry, it'll be easier than nailing a Womp Rat my T-16 back home. No joke, it made a ton of money. But Michael thinks Rogue One will be a landmark film for a reason most filmgoers didn't even appreciate. Oscar season is heating up, and the guilds are finally weighing in with the SAG Award nominations first out of the gate. If you want to look back rather than forward, the Library of Congress added some new films to its list of notable works. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to name the only two books that you gave a perfect 4-star rating to during the year 2016. On Inside Baseball, we'll look again at the talks between studios and theater owners over theatrical windows. Something is brewing, if only because when Apple gets involved, people start to panic, apparently. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, Michael, we turn it over to you, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, and we also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, LA Times, New York Times, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, $290 million worldwide. It will make more than $1 billion when all is said and done. And some people will foolishly say it's a disappointment because it didn't make $2 billion like A Force Awakens.
So what you're saying is the first movie that is not in the actual Star Wars lineage, that's not technically a part.
Well, it practically is.
Yeah, it practically is.
It's a standalone in a most modest way, you know.
Right.
That, I mean, it ends right before Star Wars: A New Hope begins.
Right. So, well, don't tell me. Spoiler alert.
That's before it's about the Death Star stealing the plans. Everybody knows that. It's not a secret.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying that, I would agree. I agree with you. You know what? If it makes $1 billion, guess what? Disney's not crying, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what are the numbers here? What's going on here? It made a ton on Thursday night. It had the biggest Thursday of the year, made $29 million on Thursday night. That's when you knew it was going to be okay. There was some bad weather, but that sort of petered out. So that didn't affect the weekend box office. On large format screens, which includes IMAX, and why break it down? Because I don't have stock in IMAX. Rogue One in North America made $38 million from large format screens, from premium screens. But they did have 3D numbers. It's been a while since the studios have talked about 3D, and that's because there's no good story to tell. But they did have one here. 3D ticket sales, they say, were 38% of all ticket sales in North America. I assume it's even higher overseas. But 38% of all tickets sold were 3D.
That's right. Now, what I thought was interesting, and Box Office Mojo really pointed this out, they said that is despite the fact that 84% of the 4,157 screens that it played on here, or sorry, theaters that it played in here in North America were 3D capable. But the reality is just because a theater is 3D capable doesn't mean that all of its showings are in 3D. So the question is...
Well, nobody ever thought that.
Right.
Right? Aren't most theaters now 3D capable?
Not most, but
84% of his 4,100 were.
Well, theaters. Now, there's a difference between the number of theaters that are 3D capable and the number of screens that are 3D capable. So most theaters have one screen in them that is 3D capable. So that makes sense.
So that's 4,000 hard tops. That's not 4,000 screens.
Correct. Yes. And believe me, I have asked about that number numerous times. So okay. Yes, because I've always thought it was screens up until, you know, just last year. And I thought, how did I reach this age thinking that number was screens when it's just exactly what you just said? It's sights, not screens.
You're saying one out of six movie theaters in the country are not 3D capable. They don't have a single screen that can show a movie in 3D. You're talking like drive-ins and mom and pop theaters, right?
Exactly.
Those are all the little guys.
Exactly.
Pretty much every multiplex has 3D in pretty much available in every theater, right?
In every... Well, yes,
they're all digital now, right?
In every complex, however, not every screen might be 3D capable. And here's why. People will say, well, no, you know, you just move the tech. No, part of it is the screen itself may not be, the actual physical screen at the front of the auditorium may not have enough what's called gain to actually show a 3D film on it. So, yes, any theater,
if
any
screen was made in the last 5 years, if it was a movie theater built or a multiplex with 20 screens, what's your guess?
My guess is, depending on the size of the auditorium and whether they wanted, you know, to pay the 3D upcharge themselves mm-hmm. because to install it, it's probably a silver screen and it probably is 3D capable.
Certainly the biggest ones would be.
Yes, absolutely.
So now you're suggesting, though, in your note, that there's no way of telling how many showings were in 3D versus 2D. Well, they said 38% of ticket sales were sold in 3D. That we assume is a fact, or is that an estimate?
No, that's a fact.
Okay. And I'm confused by the fact that they said ticket sales. Normally, they talk about the gross. What percentage of the gross is 3D? And I'm thinking somebody somewhere made a mistake, that they conflated the two.
You know what it is? It's that they're, you know, you can only say gross, receipts, take, box office so many times. So what I understand what you're saying, that, well, was it 38%?
That's a very different number, though.
No, I agree with you. They're trying to say that 38% of the gross was 3D. Okay.
Well, that's a different number. So it's more like 33% of ticket sales.
That's probably true. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So they did mess up when they say tickets sold, that what they meant to say was 38% of the box office was from 3D sales.
Yes. But as a writer, you're kind of like, gee, I can't say box office is gross again.
That's wrong, though. It's wrong.
No,
it's not accurate.
I would also agree with that. And that is why you don't trust everything you read on the internet.
Yeah. I thought that because they want to use the bigger number. That's basically the idea. So they want to talk about the percentage of gross because ticket sales is much lower.
Well, they also probably don't know the percentage of ticket sales. So, correct.
All right. So we know that, hey, it didn't even break 40%, but that's to be expected. It's just not a movie, you know, and probably come Sunday, people were stopping to see it in 3D pretty much at all. You know, 3D, is this a movie that's going to have a 3D life like Jurassic World? I don't think so. I haven't heard anybody talking about seeing it in 3D.
No, I mean, Doctor Strange, I went to see in 3D because everybody said, oh, on this one, you got to go see in 3D. Okay, then guess what? I'm going to see it in 3D. Everybody said so. I'm going to go see it in 3D.
Yeah, that probably had a good run in 3D. I don't think this one will, but it had a great opening weekend, obviously, here in North America. What was it? What was the final number? It was
150-something million dollars.
$150 million. That was the final, the latest estimate.
I just shaved $5 million off, which, you know, maybe for Disney doesn't matter, but to us it does. $155 million in North America this weekend.
That makes it one of the 20 highest grossing debut weekends of all time, including the Thursday number. Take out the $29 million and suddenly you got a different ballgame, don't you?
Yes.
Which is what you should do, because that's not what it made on opening weekend. It made it over 4 days, not three.
That is correct.
Why they continue, you know, why not include Wednesday's gross? It just boggles my mind. But anyway, it's a huge success. The third biggest opening weekend, including a four-day weekend of the year, with Captain America Civil War and Batman versus Superman doing even better. But it's a great launch. All these numbers are fine, but why is this movie going to be remembered? I mean, it's part of a huge franchise. It'll be remembered. But why is this really a landmark film? And most moviegoers didn't even realize it. I talked to people and they were like, what?
Well, I actually was looking this movie up on IMDb and there was Peter Cushing's name. And I thought,
exactly.
Wait, how did they use old footage? How did this work? Because Peter Cushing, I'm pretty sure he was kind of a senior citizen in 1977 when that film Star Wars was made, and of course he played a character in that film, and I thought
the
same character he plays in this film, and apparently ILM Industrial Light and Magic brought him back for this film.
Right, he died in 1994, and in Rogue One he gives a new performance, probably one of the best performances in the film, frankly. It's a low bar, but there you go. But I know that most people didn't even realize the guy was dead. They had another actor stand in for the physical body, and then they used their technology to, you know, make Peter Cushing come to life. And they gave him new dialogue, which raises the question. I'm sure it's happening, but I know they have like strings of words and letters that you can read off to cover like almost every variation, you know, like you read for 5 minutes and you've covered every sort of word or phrase or thing, and they can use those to break them down into new sentences. I bet they've got James Earl Jones doing that. You know, let's record your voice so that we can manipulate those phrases and words into whatever we need.
Oh, that's actually very interesting. That's a good point because, look at the movie Gleason. If you can see that movie, it's about a football player, Steve Gleason, who has ALS and who loses his voice. And he knows he's losing it, so he actually does exactly what you just said, Michael. He records his voice. Now, mind you, he was recording it while he was losing his voice, so
sure,
it didn't sound exactly like him. Well, I guess you could also go to Roger Ebert, who actually had his voice, when he lost his ability to speak. The voice that he used was his own voice, taken from the hundreds and hundreds of hours of the television show he did. All of the words were there, and so the scientists were able to take them and parse them, and he could type out what he wanted to say, and it would come out in his own voice.
But not really anywhere near to what we have with Peter Cushing.
Not at all.
No, it was not. Didn't sound remotely as normal or convincing as it did with Peter Cushing. This is a full performance in a film by a dead person.
Correct.
I mean, obviously he didn't give it, but they created this performance, and I think it really opens up remarkable possibilities.
Do you remember that movie, The Congress, with Robin Wright?
I know of it.
Well, basically, she is playing a character that is being scanned so that she's giving up the rights to her likeness, and they're going to basically have her star in movies, in perpetuity, with her likeness and her body scanned, her voice is scanned, and then she's basically selling it.
And celebrities are getting this done. They are paying to have their bodies scanned right now, whatever age they are. I mean, Justin Bieber should do it. You think of an actor, they can get scanned at 20, 40, 60, and 80. And then you want to make Benjamin Button, or you want to have a scene with your younger self. You don't have to use another actor in makeup. You don't have to do some – you can just use yourself.
That is correct.
I mean, it really opens up very interesting creative possibilities. Obviously, there's a big market for, putting people in concert and having, you're going to have Frank Sinatra and all that. Well, I think you're going to see more. I know you're going to see more and more of that. And you see what happened with Peter Cushing. People didn't even know it was happening. They're just accepted as a scene in the movie.
Well, of course, it also opens up a legal Pandora's box, which we won't get into here because, of course, the rights, to
you
got to
pay. Do you sign a contract where you've given away your rights to have your character recreated in future movies without you making a penny? No, you don't.
Well, and that's the question. That's one of the issues is that are you doing that? And I'm sure lawyers smarter than us will figure it out.
Yeah, and the powerful actors, you're not going to be able to use, Cary Grant without his estate's approval.
No.
But it's going to be I think it's a really interesting creative tool. I don't think it's just a question of, you can bring someone back to life who. I think it's going to open up possibilities for storytelling. That's kind of really fascinating, I think. And I think that's why this movie, I know they've done similar things before, but I feel like they really took it to a whole new level. I mean, you just don't even think about it. There's Peter Cushing doing a scene, and most people had no idea that guy was dead.
Well, I just can't wait to see the latest Katharine Hepburn movie.
Exactly. So that was the number one movie of the box office. It'll be remembered for a long time to come, if only because of the digital manipulation that brought Peter Cushing back to life. And number two around the world is The Great Wall, the Chinese action fantasy starring, who is it, Christian Bale?
Matt Damon.
It opened on a Thursday. Just like they do in Hollywood now, it's made $64 million so far at the box office. But I was kind of amused. They included the Thursday night totals in their weekend. I was like, just like Hollywood.
Yeah. Movies in China often open on a Thursday or a Wednesday. They don't go necessarily from Friday.
Well, every Hollywood movie tends to open on a Thursday. There's very few that do open on a Friday. Maybe indie films, but studio movies are opening Thursday night as a matter of course.
Yes.
Right, and it happens apparently in China and perhaps all over the world, right? And that practice must be spreading to all the major developed countries.
Well, in Brazil, the movies open, as all movies open on a Thursday. It doesn't matter Hollywood or Brazilian or independent. Movies open on a Thursday, period.
Who wants to work on Friday? Nobody. At number three is Office Christmas Party, $43 million over the weekend, $84 million worldwide. At number four is another Disney film, Moana. $27 million over the weekend. That's at $280 million worldwide. It has a long ways to go. So it's got a long campaign. It's done quite well in North America. It'll pass the $200 million mark, and it's going to make a lot more money overseas.
I can't believe you just jumped over the Great Wall like that. No pun intended.
Is there more you want to say about it?
Well, look, this is a $150 million film, right, from Legendary. Everybody's eyes were on this film, right, because it's Zhang Yimou, a very well-known Chinese filmmaker. I love his movies. And it's Matt Damon. It's an English-language film. It's kind of a co-production. It's a big budget, and it didn't get great.
Is it
great.
A co-production?
I believe so. Yes, it's a China-U.S. co-production.
Major studio, though.
Legendary.
All right.
Legendary East, actually. And so what I loved was in the Variety story of its box office, they actually said, The Great Wall played on 364 million IMAX screens. Now, I know yeah. China is big, but it's not that big.
I think they didn't mean to say million.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, no, it's a big commercial roll of the dice. We'll have to see where it ends up, but it had a good launch.
What I also thought was interesting was the movie played on approximately 45% of available movie screens in China. And that is what you get when you don't have a free market.
What would that mean in the U.S. if you played on 45% of available screens? How many screens would that be?
That would kind of be like saying that most of the movie screens at Regal theaters or AMC theaters were taken up with one movie.
Right. I'm just wondering the number, the total screens as opposed to theaters.
That would be close to 20,000 screens or no, 45. It would probably be like 18,000 screens.
That's a lot of screens. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them isn't playing on that many, but it did make $20 million over the weekend, $720 million worldwide. And number six is a movie that went up against Rogue One here in North America. It's Will Smith's Collateral Beauty. Disastrous opening weekend, the lowest of his career practically for a big movie, or at least a wide opening. It made $11 million in 17 territories on its opening weekend. Obviously, it'll play in a lot more places overseas, and he's still a big draw. People said, oh, he's doing terrible. Movies are collapsing. He just had one of his highest grossing movies of all time earlier in the year, Suicide Squad. He's going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going to be fine. He needs a comeback. He needs a comeback critically.
Yes, critically he does. At number seven is Hacksaw Ridge, the Mel Gibson Oscar hopeful. $10 million over the weekend, $120 million worldwide, which triples the reported budget and lets everybody breathe a sigh of relief. At number eight is The Wasted Times. This is a Chinese Hong Kong thriller starring Ziyi Zhang. I'm not sure what the plot is, but it made $9 million on its opening weekend. Obviously crushed by The Great Wall. I don't know what its budget is, but hopefully it'll be okay in the end. And number nine is a movie I saw last night, La La Land, or as I call it, Blah Blah Land.
Oh.
$8 million over the weekend, $60 million total. I was not impressed, sadly.
Man, you are like you're going to hate Amelie.
I guess so. Well, it's hard to make a good musical. I was glad they made a musical. I appreciated that. It's like seeing a Western every once. You're just glad to see a Western. I'm just glad to see them dancing. I like Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. I thought they saved their best songs for the Broadway show, Dear Evan Hansen. And I just found it very rote and their arguments about jazz and her career. It just felt very routine and familiar. And it just felt like a movie referencing other movies rather than real characters in a real life. It never came to life for me, even close.
So most Quentin Tarantino movies, then. It's just like that.
I didn't like it. It's okay. Not an action violent film. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, a movie referencing other movies.
It did come to life.
Yeah.
It didn't reference other movies in a way that seemed fresh and original.
Right. And the idea is Tarantino did that in ways that were fresh and original, but go ahead.
Right. I tend to like musicals where people can sing and dance and, you know, they can work without that, but neither of them is really a good singer. So that's also a problem. I can enjoy that. I enjoy the naturalness of it, if you want, or the vulnerability of two people who aren't great singers singing. That's okay. That's all right. But you know, by and large, you really want people who can belt it out and really dance. But they were fine. They weren't the problem. It was the script and the songs.
Well, like belt it out like The Rock in Moana.
Yeah, they created a song that fit his voice, and he did a good job with it. It was only one song. It wasn't the whole movie.
That's correct.
But there you go. I didn't love it. It's a shame. I wish I liked it better, but then I didn't like Whiplash either.
Oh, okay. Well, you stand amongst the minority on that one.
Mm-hmm. At number 10 is a UK horror film called Pandora, another $7 million over the weekend, $17 million and counting. At number 11 is Sing, the animated movie that's sort of like an American Idol tale, rags to riches. It's going to come to North America soon. $6 million over the weekend, $17 million and counting in 15 overseas territories. And number 12 is Arrival. This one has really had good legs, the Amy Adams movie. $6 million over the weekend, $140 million worldwide. Still hasn't tripled its budget, but it's getting there. And number 13 is Sully, the Clint Eastwood film. Another $4 million over the weekend, $230 million worldwide. And number 14 is another Oscar hopeful, just like La La Land. This one I actually really did like. Manchester by the Sea, $4.6 million over the weekend, just under $15 million and counting. At number 15 is Trolls, another animated film, $325 million worldwide. And running down to try and find a new movie. Oh, here's one at number 17. It's Will You Be There? This is a Korean time travel romance. It stars the young actor Byun Yo-han. It made $3 million, $3.6 million on its opening weekend. Byun Yo-han, is a member of the celebrity friendship group called BYH48. Which is a joking reference to the Japanese pop group AKB48, which had 48 members. So the joke is this brat pack of Korean celebrities are so big, there's like 48 of them. So, you know, I'm sure he hates it. Who knows? But it's a movie about a man traveling back in time when he's dying of cancer to see his younger self and make sure he, you know, tries to woo the girl he always loved. So there you go. I just love the Korean celebrity culture, the BYH48 gang. It's just, to me, I found that very amusing. Apparently, I'm the only one. And going back farther down, there's one more film. It's a Canadian film. Ballerina is at number 23. It made $2 million on its opening weekend in two territories. I'm not sure which ones they were. Canada, I guess. But I'm not sure where this opened up. But it's a film, an animated movie about a little girl who yearns to be a dancer, obviously. I thought it was notable because it stars Elle Fanning, the voice of Elle Fanning, who's had a great year. In 2016, she's had Neon Demon, Ballerina, obviously, 20th Century Women, which I quite liked, a very strong female ensemble, and I thought she was the best thing in the movie, Elle Fanning, and then Live by Night, which is going to open up in a few days, directed by Ben Affleck. So good year for her. Well, and I wonder if it's Elle or Elle Fanning.
It's Elle Fanning.
Elle Fanning. Well, there you go. I said it wrong the entire time, but we're all going to learn how to say her name correctly soon because she's had a great year.
She has, so have some of the nominees for the SAG Awards.
That's right. Now, this is a Guild Award. These are people who actually, many of them are, they're not all members of the Oscars. There's a lot more members of SAG than the Oscars, but a chunk of these people actually vote on the Oscars. So it's the first award nomination that actually means something as far as tea leaves and reading and predicting what might get Oscar attention.
Yes, this is the Screen Actors Guild Awards, if you're wondering what SAG means. And we're not going to go over all the nominees here, but they have, let's just do three of them. And by three categories here. The Outstanding Performance by a Cast in a Motion Picture, Captain Fantastic, Fences, Hidden Figures, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. And this is kind of honoring, you know, an entire cast at like
this
an
is their
ensemble.
Best movie category.
Yes, but it's not necessarily best feature as much as best acting, best ensemble in a film.
Right. So if a movie with two people might not score there, but then again, look at Fences. You're looking at three people, really. You're looking right. There's a great ensemble of actors in this movie, but it's really Denzel Washington, Viola Davis, and the young man playing his son. That's 98% of the movie is those three people. So that's a pretty small ensemble, but fair enough. Four of those five movies will certainly be Oscar contenders, I think. Captain Fantastic, I think, is an outlier.
Yeah.
You know, that's an unusual, but it could be, you know, if we start to see it in the DGA and the Producers Guild and other guilds, we'll know, hey, Captain Fantastic has momentum. One thing to keep in mind is some movies weren't eligible or weren't ready to be seen by SAG, or they didn't send out screeners. And if you don't send out screeners, you're not going to get a SAG nomination. I don't think Martin Scorsese's Silence, it's looking like it's going to be a rough road to hoe for this movie to get some Oscar attention. But it didn't even have a chance with SAG because they didn't get screeners to the voters.
Right. And then we have, of course, the Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor in a Leading Role. Of course, Casey Affleck, Manchester by the Sea, was expected. Andrew Garfield is looking up for Hacksaw Ridge. Ryan Gosling, who you hate, for La La Land.
I love Ryan Gosling.
I know. I'm just saying, for La La Land. Viggo Mortensen for Captain Fantastic. He's getting a lot of love for that film. And Denzel Washington for Fences.
That's right. Yeah, you know, you can see if a movie has strong support if it's getting multiple nominations in multiple categories. So, for example, in the best performance by an actress, we do see Meryl Streep And then in supporting actor, we see Hugh Grant. And, you know, so we know, okay, so they really liked that movie. They gave multiple acting nominations to Florence Foster Jenkins, even if it didn't get a Best Picture nomination, or at least their equivalent of that. So we know that there's a serious amount of love. And again, Captain Fantastic, it wasn't just that the movie squeaked in. No, they gave Viggo Mortensen a top nod as well.
And they gave Amy Adams a top nod for outstanding performance by a female actor in a leading role, along with Emily Blunt for The Girl on the Train. I guess somebody saw that movie. Natalie Portman for Jackie. Emma Stone for La La Land, the movie that Michael just loves. And Meryl Streep for Basically Breathing. No, for Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yes, and again, Emily Blunt seems like the outlier there. We're assuming that that's just sort of a quirk of the SAG Awards, and all the others are serious Oscar contenders. As is, of course, La La Land. There's no question it'll get a lot of Oscar nominations. It's about actors and artists in Los Angeles. It's a love letter to movies and a love letter to musicals. I'm sure they're going to eat it up. I wish I liked it more.
Now, you kind of have highlighted here some Oscar fixes that The Hollywood Reporter has kind of...
Yes, I love this. There's it was a good article with some good suggestions for the Oscars. I think they're interesting. Most of them, I think most people would agree with. They had four or five ideas of what they think the Oscars should do to improve things. One of them was they should just stick with 10 films. Instead of having the sliding scale every year, they said they don't go down to five. The more movies you celebrate, the better. They've had 10 in the past. Everybody understands a best 10 of the year list. Just make it 10. Stop this nonsense where it's 7, 8, 9, 6, 7, 9, 8. Just make it 10. It means more movies get honored. There's nothing wrong with a top 10 of the year list. Everybody does it. It's not too many. It's not going to clearly not going to bring in a bunch of big studio movies because they're not playing that game anymore. But it does give more attention and focus to 10 good movies. So why not?
They also say to combine sound editing and sound mixing to best sound. I get it. I totally get it. But at the same time, they are two different crafts.
But they say nobody voting on it understands what those crafts are and the distinction between sound editing and sound mixing. And surely they work hand in hand. And often you'll see the same people in the mix, won't you?
Sometimes, but very often. I mean, sound mixers, that is a very specific job. And sound editing is even more specific. Sound editing is you're literally going out to find all of the sound. So in a war movie where there's bullets flying everywhere, you have to find the sound for all that stuff that may not actually exist in the production track. So you have to go out and find everything and make up everything and then cut it together in sync with the film. Then the mixer comes in and actually plays with the levels and makes things audible. So it's totally different. It's like saying, well, you know, just diving and swimming, just make it together. Well, yeah, but one jumps in the pool from out, you know, it's just, yeah, I get it. It's water, but it's not the same.
Yes, but the point is that if you look at the actual awards that are given, they're almost always the same. Very rarely do they have a split decision in sound editing and sound mixing. Usually if you win sound editing, you win sound mixing. If you win sound mixing, you win sound editing.
What? As a film, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that I agree with. Yes.
That's saying why split them up? In 2010, it was Inception. In 2011, it was Hugo. In 2012, we have a split. We had a tie. Skyfall and Zero Dark Thirty won best sound editing, and Les Mis won best sound mixing because it was done live on the set.
Right.
In 2013, it was Gravity. 2014.
No, but I understand
that. But again, so they do split sometimes. People are making distinctions. But this raises the question.
But the people are different. The actual people who win are different.
Yes.
Yeah, because they're different. It's like, okay, yeah, makeup and hair. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, hair isn't going to do your makeup and makeup's not going to do your hair. They're different people.
Which raises the question of their most interesting suggestion, which is that they should limit voting to your area of expertise and best picture.
I always thought that.
Vote on sound editing and mixing, and that's your area, and that's where you pick the nominees. They say, hey, you know what? You don't really know how makeup works. You don't really know how cinematography works. You don't really know how costumes work. Vote for what you know about. Pick best picture and in your area of expertise. So actors vote for actors. Even now, that's how the nominations are created, but they say this should continue through the end.
I agree
now,
with that.
That's obviously hugely controversial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be because, you know, people don't want to lose their power to vote for other categories.
And what do you think of it?
I agree with that sentiment that, you know, please, if I'm a sound designer, I don't want it to be a popularity contest. I want sound designers saying, look, I know how hard it was to make that film Zero Dark Thirty. Okay. And so for you this year, your best sound editing. I don't want basically a whole bunch of people in cinematography or acting or makeup deciding, well, I like that movie, so I'm going to vote for it in this category.
And it would mean, obviously, fewer sweeps.
Correct.
It would mean just because you made a movie best picture, you didn't just tick it off on every category. So it's an interesting thought. I doubt that the Oscar voters would actually like it. I don't know. I've reached out to some to see what they think about it, to see if they'll give me some anonymous response. It does have a certain appeal. One hates to make radical changes. You know, it's like, hey, we've been doing this way for 90 years. Why change now? And I can empathize with that. But it is... And I also think you should be voting not just for Best Picture, but for Best Foreign Film, Best Documentary, and Best Animated Film. Should only documentary filmmakers vote on Best Documentary? I don't know. I feel like for the picture categories, those four, that should be everybody as well.
Okay.
I don't think it should be, you know, I think everybody can vote on Best Animated Film, but maybe they think it should just be animators. That's fair enough, too. But it's an interesting argument. I think, that really does, and it takes care of what you talk about with combining sound editing and sound mixing. Their argument was nobody knows what it means. Well, yeah, that's why you shouldn't be voting on it. And the people who do know sound editing and sound mixing, they actually know the distinction and they know there are different people. Unlike me, they know that it's different people doing those jobs and it's not the same names coming back to grab another Oscar, and they appreciate the distinction and they will do a better job of awarding the Oscar.
Well, certainly, part of the Oscar race always includes the shortlist, the documentary shortlist and the foreign language shortlist. And this week, there were 9 films that were announced as being on the shortlist for this year's Oscars, as voted on by the, I guess there is a committee that puts this together, a foreign language nomination committee, and they do watch all the films. That is part of their job.
And groups of them watched groups of films, yeah.
Right. And so the big snubs, I guess, Francis L. didn't get nominated, the Paul Verhoeven film. Chile's Neruda by Pablo Larraín didn't get nominated. And Spain's Julieta from Pedro Almodovar didn't get nominated. However, one of my favorite films of the year, Tony Erdmann from Germany, did.
Right. I wouldn't call them snubs because nobody's guaranteed a slot. And it's not like there was a lot of other just were popular films. And so they thought, well, they'll have to make it. But of course, they can't. There's only 5 slots.
That's right. My Life as a Zucchini from Switzerland also made it. Now, there were 2 films from English speaking countries that are on the shortlist. Australia. And what was the other one?
Canada. I don't know. Canada. Canada's movie's in French.
Yeah. It's Only the End of the World by Xavier Dolan.
Right, which a controversial film with very poor reviews from Cannes, but it made the shortlist.
Yeah, I just cannot believe that film made the shortlist, but okay.
Well, there you go. I'm a big fan of Xavier Dolan, but I haven't seen that film yet.
Well, but I wonder if years and years and years from now, maybe 20, 30 years from now, the Library of Congress will be picking one of the films we just mentioned for the National Film Registry.
Well, they won't be the foreign films because they're only American movies that they include on the National Film Registry.
Good point. Good point.
So it won't be those foreign films, but the movies that are going to be up for Oscars will obviously be in the mix. They named 25 different bodies of work. Some of them are like collections of short films, and most of them make sense. Everything from Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Steamboat Bill Jr., the Buster Keaton film, to Rushmore, one of my favorite films of the 90s. But you tend to point out and go, what? Why is this on there? That's sort of the fun of it. One of them that's really a puzzler is Ball of Fire, the Howard Hawks film. 10 Howard Hawks films are already on the list. This movie I've never really liked. It's Barbara Stanwyck, Howard Hawks, 2 of my favorites, but I don't really care for Ball of Fire. There's certainly a lot of you could have even had another Howard Hawks film to have and have not could be on the list. That's not on there yet. That's a much better movie. I'm not quite sure why Ball of Fire made the list.
Well, what about The Breakfast Club? You know,
well,
they didn't forget about that.
That these are movies that are there for cultural reasons, not simply because they're saying this is a masterpiece. They're there because they are iconic or they did something unusual, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is a great movie, but obviously also was technologically significant in combining live action and animation. The Breakfast Club had a great cast. It's an iconic movie. It's entered the popular culture. And it has stood the test of time as in terms of a totemic movie, whether it's a great film. Most people would say not. It's a fun film. It's a good film. If you grew up with it, you loved it. I like it. It's certainly my favorite John Hughes movie. But it's not simply that they're not saying these are masterpieces as such, though they usually are important movies. They're saying these are significant movies. And so it's not quite the same thing. The one other that really puzzled me was, well, Lost Horizon puzzles me, the 1937 film. It's got big sets and great cinematography, and I guess that's why they thought it should be on there, because it's certainly not a good movie. But I think that's weird. But they say, well, you know, it entered the phrase Shangri-La into the popular culture. I'm like, okay, but I still don't think it's a significant film. But the one that really puzzled me is A Walk in the Sun. This is a 1945 war film. It's by Lewis Milestone, who made All Quiet on the Western Front. This one stars Dana Andrews, and it really took me a while to figure out why people would think this should be on this list. And I think it's sort of a non-traditional war movie. It follows a platoon with a mission, but it's not about the war and the battle scenes. It's kind of very episodic, and it focuses in on the characters and how they are musing over their life. And then there's sporadic bits of violence, and you come back to these guys in a platoon. And it's also maybe significant because it uses a theme song as a recurring motif throughout the movie, and it's not a musical, obviously. So it's kind of like High Noon. A lot of people remember the song in that movie. And this was one of the first ones to do that. So I've never seen it. It's on the list, and I'm going to go check it out. And if you go to our website, showbizsandbox.com, you'll find we've linked when there is video available online for some of these silent films and these early shorts. You can watch them right away. So if you want to see the 1916 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or Suzanne, a piece about the filmmaker who made that documentary, or Steamboat Bill Jr., or this collection of shorts in Oklahoma done by Solomon Sir Jones back in the 20s, you can find them all online, and you can find the links to them right on showbizsandbox.com.
Well, I'm glad Jenny Livingston's documentary Paris is Burning made it.
That's both a great film and a pretty significant one. Yeah, there's good movies on here. I mean, I don't love The Lion King, but that's on here. I like The Princess Bride a lot. There's a lot of fun movies. Funny Girl's not a great movie, but it's an iconic film with Streisand. East of Eden has obviously James Dean. A lot of good movies on the mix.
Well, those are the movies that the Library of Congress selected for the National Film Registry. But every week, you pick from the thousands of books that are published, you pick a few that are, you know, really worthwhile, worth our attention, and you let them know about it, let us know about them here during our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter is a book lover's best friends, and it's where you actually have a whole list of books, not just one or two, but like hundreds of them, books that are worth paying attention to. What are your picks this week, Michael?
Nothing.
Oh, what?
Well, yeah, because most books come out by Black Friday, which is the day after Thanksgiving. So they want them in the store. So when people swarm to their local bookstore, that their books are available for the holiday shopping season. So December tends to be kind of a slow month. Now, if you go to my website, you will find picks in every category, mystery, sci-fi, romance, cookbooks, you name it. But it's kind of a slow time of the year. So I thought I would look back, and I wondered, what books had I given a perfect score to? 4 stars out of 4. And there were just 2 books all year. One is new and one is a reissue. The new book is called Evicted by Matthew Desmond. It's about evictions and how the cycle of poverty is caught up in housing, the issue of housing. It is a great book. He embedded himself, I think it was Milwaukee, and lived with poor people and met with slumlords, basically, and just followed people for like well over a year to document their lives. So it's great narrative nonfiction. He also had some original research done of breaking down of numbers to look at evictions and how they affect people's lives. It's really an eye-opening book. It's very gripping tale. It's also very interesting in terms of what he reveals about the cycle and how it works and the mindset of people who are living in these slums. And it answers a lot of questions you might have about why would someone use food stamps to buy lobster? Why would someone live in a home and not take care of it? Well, when you know you're leaving 3 months later and the landlord's not putting any money into it, you'd feel kind of stupid if you sunk money into a slum because you know you're going to have to leave in a few weeks. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in the book. It's really a good tale and also really, really interesting. And that's definitely one of my favorite books of the year. You'll see it on a lot of lists. A lot of people had Evicted by Matthew Desmond on their best of the year list.
What about Black Wings Has My Angel by Elliot Chase? This is a book I've never heard of, and yet it's a classic, according to you.
That's right. It's been reissued this year by New York review books, NYBR, New York Book Review, or New York Review of Books.
It's one of them.
I can't remember what the mix of the acronym is. But anyway, New York Review of Books has a great imprint, and they are constantly reissuing books in trade paperbacks. Lovely cover designs. They're all sort of similar. So, you know, it's like the Penguin. You're like, oh, yeah, that's New York Review of Books. There it is. Anything they put out is of interest. I swear to God, every single book they put out, if I read it, I'm like, I love it. They find undiscovered gems, books that have fallen out of print, authors that have fallen out of favor, and they represent them to the world. And you go, wow, that's great. That's certainly the case with this one. And this is a classic noir mystery. It's a great book. The only thing bad about it is the title, Black Wings Has My Angel. Just call it Black Wings. And then that sounds a lot better, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It was hard. Yeah, it was hard for me even to say it, because as I was saying it, I thought, that's got to be a misprint.
Exactly. It's by Elliot Chase, this guy who was, you know, of course, he wrote some great books. Then he fell out of favor. This book was only available in France for a number of years. It was out of print in English. Barry Gifford, who, of course, had some success as a writer, was about to bring it back when the publishing imprint he was working with fell apart. Then Elliot Chase died. So this book has really disappeared off the radar for a long time. But it's a classic noir. Anybody who loves those great bleak crime movies. This is about a guy who gets caught up with a beautiful but dangerous gal. They decide to do a bank heist. What could possibly go wrong? It's a really, really good book. Great, great fun. So check it out.
Well, I wonder, you know, there's been a lot of talk about conflicts of interest in politics, and we're not going to get into that and why that's a kind of a new topic these days after our recent election here in the U.S. But I wonder, you know, Oprah Winfrey has this Book of the Month Club, right? And she's always picking it's an Oprah pick. Well, now she's actually taking it one step further. She's like, well, why pick other people's books? I can pick my own. She's started her own imprint.
Well, that's right. Oprah has launched a new imprint. Forbes magazine has launched a new imprint. A lot of people are seeing that there's money to be made in publishing. Yes, there's been this, you know, transfer to ebooks, and there's been turmoil in the industry, but a lot of money is spent on books. There's a lot of money to be made. I'm sure Oprah was approached 20 years ago to launch a book imprint. So she's just decided to do it now. But I am sure this is just the finale of a long negotiation. There isn't a publishing house in the country that wouldn't have been happy to let Oprah have her own imprint. It's sort of a luxury brand item. Top editors get it. Sometimes a name brand author will get it. Oprah is, you know, her own force. And she, of course, back in the day, could sell a million copies of a book just by naming it to her book club. Now it's really Oprah Magazine that does, is doing the new book club picks. So I don't think there's a conflict here. She's just saying, I want to tell you I love this book and I'm going to do even more to support them and make them happen. So we'll have to see how that turns out, how involved she is. I'm sure she'll be heavily involved in the picking of the books as far as promoting it and all that sort of stuff. We'll have to see, but I'm sure the publishers that landed her are thrilled.
And you get a book deal, and you get a book deal, and you
exactly.
get a book deal. We all get book deals. That would be actually a big deal if we all got book deals. I wouldn't mind a book deal. I mean, I want to write
one. I see where you're
going. Yes, that's right. I am headed. Actually, I'm driving on over to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story: Michael has been bitching and moaning about TV ratings for as long as we've done this podcast.
Bitch.
That's right. He wants complete ratings for every TV show, and he wants it now. The info studios isn't getting out to the media and viewers. Even worse, so much TV watching online and non-TV devices isn't even being tracked well. Not so fast, says NBC. They want to capture those audiences too. But the network says Nielsen's new metric, dubbed Total Audience Measurement, or as I like to call it, TAM, is not remotely ready for prime time. Is NBC simply holding on to the system that gives them more money than if the real audience were nailed down? Or is it really too hard to figure out who is watching what, where they might be watching it, and exactly when? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I don't know how you said that last sentence so smoothly. Well done. That was the tricky one. Who is watching what, where they might be watching it, and exactly when? That's tricky. It's a big whoop. They're saying, well, you know, we want to make sure it's right. And if that's what the case is, I think that's fine. Obviously, everybody wants to agree on a new standard, make it make sense, and make it work for everybody. We want accuracy above all. I don't think they're just dragging their heels because they make more money with the old system. Do you? I mean, it's possible, right? The networks don't want active measurement because they might lose money?
Possibly, but at this point, they know that active measurement is coming.
Yeah.
Movie star Julia Roberts is going to star in a TV series.
Yay!
Except she isn't. The actress, who hasn't had a really satisfying critical and commercial hit in movie theaters in at least a decade, is smart to return to TV, having recently done the TV film The Normal Heart. But she's not really doing a TV show. Roberts is attached to star in a limited series called Today Will Be Different. Based on the novel by Maria Semple, it spends exactly one day in the life of Eleanor Flood, who wakes up determined to have the best day of her life. So it's basically like an autobiography for me. Think of it as a modern Mrs. Dalloway. Of course, if the miniseries clicks, they could always do a second season focused on another day in the life of Eleanor Flood, making it the chick lit equivalent to 24. But for the moment, it's a miniseries, not a seven-season commitment to a whole lot of TV episodes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It was interesting. People said, Julia Roberts is making a TV show. No, she's not. It's a miniseries. That's quite a different commitment. So I think it's important to make that distinction. Most people got it wrong. But when you look back at her movies, it's been a really Erin Brockovich is the last time she got a movie that made good reviews and good money.
Well, let me ask. I actually just checked this book, Today Will Be Different, out of the library. Is it any good?
It certainly was popular. You know, it got good reviews, and it was it did well on the bestseller list. It's certainly one that I almost checked out. You know, there's always more books than you can possibly read, but it's one that I highlighted because it did look like it was fun, and it certainly got good attention.
What do you think about this whole thing about rebooting The Honeymooners?
I mean, oh my God, they're talking about the Jeffersons, All in the Family, The Honeymooners. It's tiresome. You know, there's no reason not to revive a classic format if it makes sense. But I think it's more the format you want to revive rather than a show where it's all about the actors. You know, The Honeymooners, you don't want to redo what's the point of redoing The Honeymooners? it just doesn't work. The Odd Couple, I get, they didn't do a good job, but The Messy Roommate and The Clean Roommate, we can all identify with that. That format to me makes sense. The Honeymooners, there's nothing to The Honeymooners or I Love Lucy except the brilliant talent that made those shows. That is not, there's nothing about that. They're just stealing the name and putting it on a new sitcom. And All in the Family, The Jeffersons, dear God, you know, it's just exhausting. Come up with something new.
Photographers and filmmakers need encryption. In an open letter to camera companies, more than 150 top filmmakers and photojournalists are asking for encryption to be part and parcel of camera design so they can better protect themselves and their work. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I thought it was a big whoop. I mean, I'm intrigued that they need to have an open letter. Do you think if there was a demand from them to have it, that the camera companies would want to respond?
Yeah, I'm a little confused by this. I think that basically it's photojournalists that are saying, look, what we want is the ability to take a picture and then not have a government come in and say, no, you can't have this picture.
Yeah.
That's really
and
what
they want
they're
encrypted
to
in camera so that they don't have a vulnerable spot in the thing. Right now they take a picture and then if they catch them, they can get rid of the picture, delete it, see what it is, force them to do something with it that they don't want. It endangers their safety to have unencrypted photos on their camera.
Right. So in that regard, it's interesting in the regard of, I guess they're not trying to have DRM, right? That's not what they're doing here.
No. And it's nothing about digital rights management. It's just they want the ability to have it immediately encrypted so that they are going to be safer while covering danger zones overseas around the world. I guess it's a question of they need it in all cameras in order that they can do it in the ones that they have. It's not like they can make a special photojournalist camera. So they want it available in every camera, I guess, or most commercial cameras.
Right.
And maybe that's where the trouble is, that it's makes it annoying for people who don't want encryption.
Correct.
I guess.
Yes, that is absolutely correct, because where you have encryption, you need something else.
And so Joe Blow doesn't want encryption because it makes he's just taking pictures of his birthday party. And there you go.
Right.
But
decryption. That's the problem, is that once you lock it up, you need to unlock it, and I have a way to unlock it.
Huh. Interesting.
Speaking of technical things, the head of the FCC is stepping down. Tom Wheeler's term ran through 2018, but as is traditional, when a president is elected from a different party, Wheeler is offering his resignation. So goodbye net neutrality come January 20th when Trump takes office and Wheeler leaves. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? People doing something because it's traditional. That's going to be old-fashioned pretty soon, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm surprised he actually did do this. I mean, First off, if you would have told me 4 years ago that I would be kind of looking back on Tom Wheeler's stay at the FCC with, you know, any kind of nostalgia, I would have been shocked. But that said, you know, given the fact that, you know, all norms are being broken right now in politically, specifically, why the heck not stay on?
It would be just another year, of course.
Yes, but it would just be one more kind of way to prevent certain things that I think a majority of Americans believe should be so, in this case, net neutrality, from being overturned by corporate interests.
Well, now President-elect Trump will have two spots to fill, right? There's one open seat and the chairmanship.
Correct.
So they're going to have a Republican majority right away. So we'll see if they follow through with what they said they wanted.
Amazon may not have remotely the lineup of Netflix when it comes to programming, but they're holding their own when it comes to the lineup of countries they compete in. Amazon Prime brought India on board this week, and that means its streaming video service is now available in more than 200 countries and territories. So it wasn't just India, it was a lot more territories. Neither Netflix nor Amazon Prime is available in China, so apparently the Great Wall doesn't just keep out dragons. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, right? And they're going to do it. They're expecting it. I would have kind of thought they were already available in that many countries, but I guess it's a technical challenge to get Amazon Prime available all over the world.
Well, part of the issue is that unlike Netflix, they don't necessarily own the rights in every single territory. So they have to kind of part and parcel out what they show to whom, where, and when.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix does, but Netflix kind of, knowing where they were headed, started buying worldwide rights rather than just, you know, rights for North America or rights for English-speaking territories. They actually negotiated worldwide rights.
And they're more about their original programming now, and they have the rights to that everywhere to begin with.
Correct. Well, yes, although there were certain...
Early on, yes. They didn't have the... Yeah, they sold off some of House of Cards, etc.
Right.
But now I don't think they would make a show. That's part of the game.
That's
they
right.
Own it all over the world.
Why sell it when you know you're going to need it in France and Turkey and in Russia?
Exactly.
That was a very bad two countries to pick there at the end, given what's going on today. Well, TV reporter said NBC should be doing more to promote Olympic athletes and Olympic sports year-round. And NBC responded, they're launching an entire cable channel in partnership with the IOC. In the U.S., it will be called Olympic Channel because I guess nobody had, you know.
That's not the full name.
I know. It's called Olympic Channel, home of Team USA. But the IOC expects to launch similar channels all over the world. Figure skating and swimming and gymnastics are often treated like redheaded stepchildren on ESPN3. And college gymnastics and wrestling can rarely be found anywhere but obscure sites like the Big Ten Network. Who's going to spend money on getting the rights and filming those events? Not to mention the nonstop demand for documentaries, reality shows, following athletes around as they train, and so on. Will viewers actually tune into this, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I think it's a smart thing. It's a simple to launch a digital platform. I assume they'll be making it available online as well as on cable providers because I don't think they're going to get instant cable access. But why not make it available digitally? What are they going to charge? How much good programming do they come up with? That's the challenge. But there's a lot of great sporting events, and there's no reason people should care about swimming only once every 4 years. There's no reason they should only care about gymnastics once every 4 years. They're world-class athletes. They do great and exciting stuff. And I think a site that does a good job of getting you engaged with your country's team and athletes and following them and getting to see what it takes to become an Olympian, I think that can only help. But it's going to cost a lot of money, and they're going to have to do it right. But I think if they leverage it and do it, tag it on through the Today Show and all the NBC channel families, that it could work.
So there's been a shakeup at Warner Brothers, which is no surprise since it made money on Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman. But about the only film in ages that has been a real blockbuster and worth celebrating has been Fantastic Beasts. Heck, even Mad Max Fury Road had trouble making money last year despite the brand name and critical love. So executive Greg Silverman is out and Toby Emmerich moves up to report directly to Kevin Sugihara, the CEO of Warner Brothers Entertainment. Silverman was part of a triumvirate that included Emmerich and Sue Kroll. So in a way, Sue Kroll has been demoted and Silverman has been ousted with the usual parting gift of a startup production company backed by the studio. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know. You know studio execs better than I do. I don't really care who takes over what chair or doesn't. Is this important? Do I care? Is something going to change?
Well, here's the thing. Warner Brothers is one of the studios that makes the most movies, okay? That's number one. Number two, everybody thought this whole triumvirate thing just wasn't going to work. And
it never does.
Yeah, and for quite some time, people have been griping, executives have been griping, we don't know who is in charge over there at Warner Brothers. Who do you take your script to? Who do you take your projects to? Who's actually making the decisions? This isn't working. So finally, Susie Hara did something about it and said, all right, Emmerich, you're in. Silverman is out. Sue Kroll, guess what? You're in charge of marketing, which is what you should have been in charge of in the first place. So in a way, it's a big deal because they're finally doing what they should have done in the first place, which is pick a studio head.
And he's got a good lineup coming up, doesn't he? You look at the next year and a half, you've got the Lego Batman movie, which had a really funny trailer.
Yes,
Kong
it does.
Skull Island, which is at least an effectively commercial trailer. Chips as a feature film, Wonder Woman, Dunkirk, the Blade Runner sequel, another Lego movie, and Justice League. That's just in 2017. I'd feel pretty good about at least my commercial priorities. Obviously, they've had commercial success and not made good movies. That's been their problem lately. It looks like they're going to be making more money. If they'll be good movies, we'll have to find out. And of course, Warner Brothers had a long history of having two guys in charge at the top, didn't they? They had Terry Semel, and who was his co-chief executive?
Bob Daly, Daly and Semel. Yeah. But they were there for decades, and they actually had a very good working relationship, and each knew exactly what the one was supposed to be doing, and the other was not supposed to. So it actually worked.
So I think the difference was they were at the top.
That's right.
And they had clearly defined roles. So there's no reason a duo or a triumvirate can't work, as long as you got a marketing and a finance guy and a creative guy, and they all know their roles and they all work together well and they're in charge. I think that's the issue here.
You know the old adage, when everybody's in charge, nobody's in
Michael's
charge.
Michael's in charge.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
well,
wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
This week, we're going to be turning to a reporter from Celluloid Junkie to talk to us about this issue. Sperling Reich, thank you for joining us on Showbiz Sandbox.
Oh, you're welcome. Good to be here.
That's right. I linked to a Sperling article.
That's right. I was actually going through the notes and I was like, oh, we're going to have to find something for Inside Baseball. And what? Hey, this is something I wrote. It sounded familiar, but there's a reason I wrote it. So thank you, Michael, for I don't know how you found it, but...
Neither do I, actually.
But hey, thanks.
So you talked about this story again because of Apple, I think, was what sort of was the thing that spurred a new round of discussion about this possibility of shortening the window from theatrical to streaming video on demand.
That's right. I mean, so I guess speaking of Kevin Susihara, the head of Warner Brothers, he kind of said, look, we're in conversations with some exhibitors, some movie theater owners, to shorten this window and have a premium VOD window where like 2-3 weeks after a film is released, it can be shown for a very high price at home, basically. And, you know, nobody really said much of anything. You know, there were a few media stories. Universal then quickly came out and said, us too. No shock when you really think about it, because Universal's owned by Comcast, so who stands to benefit from a premium VOD window other than people who offer premium VOD? Guess who else might be offering premium VOD in the future? How about AT&T, which is buying Warner Brothers right now? So it's
but
no
then
shock
people
those
freaked
two.
Out a little bit. They took it more seriously because suddenly Apple was being mentioned.
Right. I mean, that was kind of the weird thing. So we received maybe like one email about that after the Warner Brothers and Universal thing. But then 2 weeks later, or a week and a half later, Apple kind of tossed their hat in the ring and said, "Oh well, we're also talking to studios about being the provider for premium VOD, about getting those movies early." They didn't really say much. Actually, Apple didn't say anything. It was Bloomberg that was quoting people close to the source. But here's the reality. What was really going on is that when you shift a window, everything behind it and in front of it shifts too. So it's like pulling on a thread of a sweater. So, you know, you can't pull on it and expect, you know, other threads not to come loose. So that said, Apple's saying, well, wait a second. We make, we're 45% of home video sales right now.
Digital.
Digital video sales right now. And 65% of premium titles, and we make a lot of money doing this thing called early electronic sell-through, where we get to sell the movie like 2 weeks in advance of it coming out on regular home video, and we make a lot of money doing that. So do you, studios. So, you know, if you're going to shift the VOD window and you're going to put something before us, that might hurt our business. You know what? Why don't we just be your vendor for that? Well, the studios, of course, knowing they want to go this premium VOD route, actually do need vendors. I don't think they're going to give an exclusive to just Apple. I think they'll say Walmart and Apple and all these tech companies. Guess what?
Amazon.
Yeah, you can all sell premium VOD titles provided you can secure them, number one. Number two, can sell them for a high value, because that is what they're looking for here. They want a transactional model. They don't want this rental thing that Netflix has where they make less money. They want somebody buying the film.
Right. But you can rent them too, right?
Well, sorry, yes. Premium VOD would be rental, but it would be a transaction, and it would be a monetary transaction at a very high level. They're talking about $50.
And that's just to watch it?
That's just to watch it. Now, you think $50, that's really high. But okay, let's take Moana, for example. Okay, here's what they're talking about. I would take my kids to see it. It's like, let's call it $10. So that would be $40 for a family of four. That's just to get into the movie theater. So for $10, I don't even have to get in the car. That's basically what you're saying to me. Mm-hmm. I wait 2 weeks, an extra $10, I'm not driving to the movie theater. They're not talking about day and date. So they're not saying the same day it opens in movie theaters, it opens on premium VOD. They're talking at least 2 weeks after the release.
That's pretty close. It's already 12 weeks after. So basically a movie opens in a theater, and we're talking about big studio films, and then about 3 months after, unless it's a really long running hit, you're going to find it on DVD and Blu-ray. And before that, 2 weeks before that, you're going to find it available for sale as a digital file, which means if you go to iTunes or Amazon and some other places, you can buy that movie digitally even before it becomes available in a physical format. So 10 to 12 weeks after a movie opens, there it is available for digital. And then a few weeks after that, you can buy it on Blu-ray or DVD.
Correct. And they're also talking about not really instituting this whole plan for 18 months at a minimum. They're also, and by they meaning industry, you know, studios and executives, they're also thinking, well, a special set-top box might be required. Although
why?
That's digital rights management.
No one's going to do that.
Nobody's going to do. I agree with you. Nobody's going to do that. They're trying to protect their content. They're trying to have some DRMs that people can't hack it, and you know, as it's streaming, capture it. I get it, but I just don't think it's going to work. That's where Apple is coming in and saying, well, we might be able to provide that for you through Apple TV.
And one, they provide digital downloads to people 10 weeks after a movie comes out. So what's the big deal? Anyway, two things to remember. One, it's already happening. You have day and date or shortly after for independent films and documentaries happening all over the country.
Yes,
it's happened all the time. We're talking about extending that practice to major studio films, making them available even sooner. I don't get it. I think if a movie's a hit, you're not going to want to do this. Why would you want to make Moana available 2 weeks after it hit theaters? Why would you want to make Rogue One available? I think it's just for the flops, which I understand. If a movie flops, why wait 3 months? People will have forgotten about it. Why not say, okay, you can buy it right away? But right. In that case, if a movie flops, who's walking around saying, gee, that movie that flopped, I really want to pay $50 to see it in my home?
Well, the question is, are you actually kind of socially putting this this social behavior of, I could go see it today, but I'll just wait 2 weeks. It'll be out on a premium VOD. And meaning, I really did want to see that film, but I know if I don't go see it, it will be in my living room sooner. So you're actually socializing the fact that if you don't go to the movies, it will come sooner.
But surely they're not going to do it with hit films. Surely they're not going to start. Surely the point is just to say, I thought the whole point of this was just to say, if a movie dies and it's already out of the theaters and it's not making any money, why wait an extra 10 weeks?
Here's what they're really trying to do.
Another 10 weeks to show it and make it available as a digital download. We've just spent all this money in advertising. Let's just throw it at people as soon as possible, because you're not making any money. It's out of the theaters. I'm not making any money because no one's buying a ticket to see it. So let's just get it out quicker. And when that happens, we'll give you a little cut of it because, hey, you know, it's so soon after it opened. But it's a flop, so nobody cares. I thought that was the only reason you wanted to do this. I don't think it's to do it for Moana and Rogue One.
Well, this is actually to replace the $8 billion that has been lost since, I think it was 2004, there's been a 25% drop in home video revenue. That's what they're really, this is what studios are really looking to do.
Does that include the whole pie?
Yes.
Does that include everything? Does that just physical and rental? Does that include streaming video on demand? Does that include pay-per-view? Does that include EST? Does that include all these things?
It is the money going to the studios. That's basically, yeah, it includes the whole pie, actually. It does.
Okay, well then fair enough. Why has it been dropping by 25%?
Because people have stopped buying DVDs. So instead of buying a DVD and a Blu-ray, people are going to rent, or they just watch it on Netflix. Now, Netflix, talk about a platform where the studios make so little money. I mean, it's not little, but they make less money than if you buy the DVD for $16 or buy the digital download for $15. They make more money doing that. That's why they like electronic sell-through.
Did they do that when they talk about their home video? Are they including the money that they get from Netflix and Hulu and other people who are paying for their film libraries?
I don't believe so. No, that is
and
not.
And that's been a lot of money.
Right. But it's kind of, again, analog dollars for digital dimes. You know, that whole.
Is it? It was billions of dollars that Netflix is spending a year on movies and TV shows.
But
billions.
I think it was $18 billion in. You know, I'd have to go back and look. It was like $18, $19 billion in 2004. And I think they made $6 billion in streaming. I'd really have to go back and look.
Yeah, I don't think they're including all the money that they're making off their movies.
Right. Well, again, this is just home video sales and rentals. I would have to go back and look.
Right. So if they're ignoring the amount of money they're making when they allow Amazon or Netflix and other platforms to show their movies for a while, I think that money counts as part of the home video revenue. If they've dropped by 24% but made 18% of it back there, okay, they're not doing so bad.
Well,
but again,
you wanted to know, so I'm going to actually tell you, okay?
Okay.
Cool. Digital electronic sell-through last year was $1.6 billion. VOD, okay, so that's rental via, you know, your cable company, let's say, $1.9 billion. Subscription streaming, that is Netflix. $4 billion.
But that number is the amount of money Netflix grosses from subscribers. That's not the money they're paying to studios. That's a different thing, isn't it? That's not what we're talking. We're talking about what is Warner Brothers making off its movies. And so that number, which is important, it talks about the overall market. But that, I believe, is just a subscriber numbers. The $8, $9 a month people pay to subscribe to Netflix. What I want to know is how much money is the studio making when Netflix pays them couple billion dollars to have rights to their library.
Well, just to give you, so yes, you're right. I apologize. Basically, all those three things that I just said were $8.9 billion total last year. Okay. Mm-hmm. The electronic sell through was $7.9 billion. Okay. So you're right. It's less money. So do you understand what I'm saying? The rental alone was $5 billion, and the total streaming was $5.7 billion. Overall, it came to $18 billion. That $18 billion does indeed count Netflix. So
it counts Netflix subscriber sales, or it counts Netflix payments to studios?
Subscriber sales, not payments to studios.
Yeah.
And right. And you know they're not getting the full $8, as you know. So that's really what they're going after. They want transactional. That's what all of the studios want.
Well, they want it all. They want transactional, and they want to make money by renting their library to people, of course.
Now, what does it, electronic sell-through is great for the studios because you kind of avoid the first sale doctrine. You can't rent an electronic movie if it's delivered electronically.
They don't really avoid it. They're getting around it right now. I still think the right is there, but you can't resell it. You can't do, all sorts of things that you should be able to do with it.
Correct.
I don't think people gave up that right, but that's true. But my general thing I want to bring you back to is, what is the point of this $50 early window? I can't imagine they're dying to make Rogue One available in homes in 2 weeks.
No, they are looking for any way to get more
when
revenue.
They have a flop.
Well, I would agree. It's probably just for flops, but I think.
And if it's a flop,
but here's
who
the thing.
Wants to pay $50 to see it? Nobody.
Here's the thing. They are just trying to change up the distribution channels. And when you do that, and it's a decades-old distribution chain, you're messing with not just the movie theater owners. You're messing with all of the video retailers as well. That includes Apple. Because what happens when all of a sudden, you know, the $50 price, as you say, Michael, doesn't really take off, and they want to lower it to 45 or 40. Well, eventually you're getting close to how much it costs to buy the film on electronic sell-through. So you know what? Actually, Apple does have a dog in this fight, and they're picking their battles early.
But it's not a decades-long tradition, because the 12-week window from when a movie leaves theaters to where it comes out on Blu-ray and DVD, that's fairly recent. I mean, these things get tweaked and changed all the time. You don't want to do it recklessly, but it happens.
No, I'm talking about a theatrical window to begin with.
Yeah. But I don't see any compelling reason for this to happen at all. I don't see there's any massive audience demand. I think they're just saying, hey, sometimes we spend $20 million to advertise a movie and it's out of the theaters in 2 weekends. Why wait an extra 2 months before making it available for people to buy? I get that. But, you know, I don't think this premium $50 thing is the solution.
I would agree. In fact, if you read my piece, you'll see I agree. Now, what do you make of this whole the VOD movie extras? Do you care that they're going to be putting photographs and behind the scenes footage in VOD?
Oh my God, not at all.
Okay,
I almost never watch it on most movies. It's rarely done well. It's Criterion, Milestone, some great small companies that do great work with extras that actually matter. Most of the time, it's just crappy stuff shot on the set. They just do it. It's boring. It's just filler material just to make you feel like you're getting something extra. I don't need it. I rarely watch it. At most, I might glance at it once. Who cares? Make it cheaper and just give it to me quicker.
All right. Well, the Comcast is doing that, and I guess they're, you know, we'll see if that matters at all. Now, that moves us along into obituaries for this week. And this week, we kind of have a surprising obituary. Alan Thicke, who was the father on Growing Pains, died at the age of 69, quite suddenly from a heart attack.
Yes, very sad. Always when somebody dies suddenly. He was a fixture for many years. Most interestingly, I think, due to his songwriting.
That's right. People had to be reminded that he actually wrote the theme songs for a number of game shows, including The Joker's Wild and Celebrity Sweepstakes and Wheel of Fortune. But he also wrote the theme songs to sitcoms like Different Strokes and The Facts of Life.
That's a lot of money. He could have retired on just those theme songs. I wish I'd written a theme song to Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, I mean, because that's still going.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the others are in reruns from now to the end of time, as far as Different Strokes and Facts of Life. But he wasn't the only person to die this week. I think one that we might have something more interesting to say is Zsa Zsa Gabor. She died at 99.
Probably. Here's the opening of Zsa Zsa Gabor's New York Times obituary. It says, Zsa Zsa Gabor, the Hungarian actress whose self-parodying glamour and revolving door marriages to millionaires put a luster of American celebrity on a long but only modestly successful career in movies and television, died Sunday in Los Angeles. She was probably 99.
Probably. Yeah, that's nice. She's obviously a early figure in celebrityness. Being famous just for being famous, the Kardashians owe her a big debt. She wasn't the first. I think as long as people have been alive, there have been people who are sort of just well-known. It happened in Victorian London. I'm sure it happened in ancient Rome, that there were people who were famous just for being famous, just because they were famous. It happens. But she obviously and her sisters did that to the T in America. And, you know, she had some good one-liners. You know, she says, I want a man who's kind and understanding. Is that too much to ask of a millionaire?
I loved her bit about her. Yeah, she said, I'm an excellent housekeeper. Every time I get a divorce, I keep the house.
Yeah, exactly. But she had a talent for making money, more power to her. And is she a harbinger of the celebrity culture and reality TV that's to come? Absolutely.
Yes, she says, there is nothing wrong with a woman encouraging a man's advances as long as they are in cash. I never hated a
she
man.
She must have had comedy people writing that for her. I mean, she would deliver those on talk shows and in interviews. Maybe she came up with some of them. But did she have people writing stuff for her, like the boys in the hall who wrote for Carson? I'll bet she did.
I bet you she did, actually.
If she was smart, she did. And she seemed to be pretty smart. She made a lot of money.
Well, we make a lot of money. Wait, no, we don't, actually. You should subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. please subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. That's how you can pay us. Rate and review the show in those aggregators. That would be a one way to kind of, you know, look, you could give us a raise, okay? Let's face it. A 100% raise, in fact. Just by rating and reviewing the show in iTunes or any one of those, Stitcher, for instance. All of that subscription information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. You can also find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook if you search for our page under Showbiz Sandbox. All of that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. I love just waiting to hear which website it's going to be this week. Michael, what is it?
God, the pressure. I was trying to think of something while you were saying that, and then you end up by saying, oh, it's going to be so great this week. And I'm like, what should I say? What should I say? I couldn't think of anything.
.com. If you can't find any of Michael's writing on that website, why not head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his entertainment coverage? Or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next year, play nice.